From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan had this to say to Congress about the state of the economic recovery.
Economic developments in the United States have generally been quite favorable in 2004, lending increasing support to the view that the expansion is self-sustaining. Not only has economic activity quickened, but the expansion has become more broad-based and has produced notable gains in employment.
Optimism from the Fed chief, but there's a debate on about how broad-based the recovery has been. The New York Times reports wage earners are not keeping up with the return of inflation. The Wall Street Journal is writing on page one about a two-tier recovery. Good news for the top 20% and something else so far for the rest. Tonight on Point, the economic recovery gap, wages, inflation, who's bouncing back and who's not in a big political year. We begin in New York tonight with John Hilzenrath, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. His front page story in today's journal is headlined, Economic Recovery Tilts to Highest Income Americans. I asked him what he means by a two-tier recovery.
We're 31 months into the official economic recovery from the recession of 2001. And you know, one thing really stands out when you look at how people are spending their money, that you know, a lot of the recovery seems to be showing up in luxury, high-income areas. And we took a deeper look at this and came to the conclusion that a lot of the recovery has been driven by higher-income households. It shouldn't be totally surprising for a number of reasons. One is we've had a big bounce back in corporate profits in the last couple of years. That's helped to drive stock prices higher. Higher-income households own a disproportionately large share of stock in the country. The dollar share of the tax cuts fell disproportionately on the wealthy. Of course, they pay the most in taxes. So when tax rates fell, higher-income households got a large chunk of the dollars back. All of this is helping to drive consumer spending, and a lot of that consumer spending is in higher-income areas.
Which leads you and economists, you're saying, to this notion of a two-tier recovery. It almost fits too neatly into the Democrats' political language, two Americas and all that. But here you are, a Wall Street Journal reporter, with this on the front page. What's the evidence for the two-tier recovery, John?
One thing you have to do is just look at how money is being spent. If you look, you know, on a broad macro level, there's been a lot of spending on durable goods. That durable goods tend to be consumed, you know, disproportionately by higher income households. If you look at what's going on with consumer confidence has risen more among higher income households than lower and middle income households. And that's actually a switch from previous recoveries. In previous recoveries, in the past, you had seen lower-income households actually keep pace or even exceed in terms of the bounce of consumer confidence. If you look at the retailers and the kind of numbers they're reporting, Neiman Marcus, Bulgari, high-end car brands like BMW or Cadillac, they all seem to be doing really well. Now, that's not to say that lower-income, middle-income households aren't getting any of the benefits. I think the proper way to describe this is they haven't gotten a large share of the benefits yet. What needs to be happening in the lower and middle-income areas is we need to see employment improving more. Now, that's just started to kick in. So a lot of the economists I talk to say we're actually at an important transition point in the recovery. As the unemployment rate falls in the months ahead, as it's expected to do, we should start seeing wages rise across the spectrum of incomes, and we should start to see the fruits of the recovery being shared more broadly. Now, of course, I don't think the Democrats are going to be making that point, but that's what the expectation is.
But for the time being, the kind of numbers and examples you said are quite striking. For example, in hotel revenues, you say in the first 5 months of this year, luxury and upscale chains, the revenues up 11%, and economy chains up only 3%.
Yeah. So here's the other important point that, again, I think the Democrats aren't really going to make in their issue ads, and that's that part of what's going on here is that higher income folks, a lot of people don't want to say this, took a big hit in the downturn itself. You know, the stock market tanked. Bonuses and stock option income fell quite a bit. And part of what we're seeing is a bounce back from the big hit that happened during the recession itself. And they'll say that that's part of what's going on. A lot of the luxury hotel chains had to really slash their prices to keep people coming during the downturn, and now they're, you know, seeing that come back.
And it's quite a bounce back, as you described with Bulgari. They're selling $5,000 gold and diamond cocktail rings, and sales up 22%. Neiman Marcus with their $500 Manolo Blahnik shoes up 13.5%. But Walmart, same store sales at Walmart up just 2%, and Payless Shoe Source sales down 1%. Pretty striking disparity.
The other thing going on here at the lower end is lower income households are a lot more sensitive to wages. Wages haven't started picking up yet because there's still slack in the labor market. But they're also sensitive to costs of day-to-day items like gasoline, milk prices, other food prices. And those prices have started rising.
And you point out, John, that there are longer-term issues at work here as well.
Right. You know, the gaps in wages and incomes have been widening over the last 20 years, and those are things that have nothing to do with either political party. These are technological trends and trends towards globalization.
1980, the top 10% of households in income had 33% of total household income. By 2000, that was up to 44% of total household income for the top 10%. It's a striking figure.
In a technology-driven economy, people with high skills are going to be rewarded, and that's part of what you're seeing in that. At the same time, people who don't have a lot of skills are exposed in a more globalized economy to competition from places like China. The other thing I should point out is that one of the reasons we're seeing this, you know, upsurge in luxury spending is that there has been a huge increase in just the, you know, the sheer number of affluent households. As of 2002, 16 million households in the country had annual incomes in the six figures. That was up, you know, adjusting for inflation, from 5 million 20 years ago. So there are a lot more affluent people out there, which I think everyone would agree is a good thing.
So if you're in the gravy, life is good, and if you're not, it can be tough. You talk about this economist saying they see things at a critical hinge point right now. What's their concern about going one way or another?
There's a couple of things that are happening right now in the economy. One is, you know, we had these tax cuts last year that led to a lot of disposable income coming back to the higher end because they pay more in taxes. The impetus that comes from that to the economy has kind of seen its maximum effect. At the same time, the stock market, as we all know, has slowed down a little bit. So there's a possibility that the higher income households are the big boost that they've seen is going to diminish a little bit in the months ahead. So at the same time, at the lower end, the job market is finally starting to kick in after many months of not producing many jobs. Companies are hiring again. And that could put some upward pressure on wages, which is going to benefit lower and middle income households. So the expectation is that, you know, right now we're kind of at this important broadening out point for the recovery. We don't know which way it's going to go. We don't know if it's going to play out. But the consensus of a lot of people is that it should start broadening out to, you know, a wider base of income levels. It wasn't until the latter years of the 90s when lower income folks, low wage workers, started to see wages rise and to reap a lot of the benefits of the productivity boom that we had. So we'll see if we're going back there.
Well, I'm sure they're waiting. John Hilzenrath, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Hilzenrath is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from New York. We're talking tonight about the economic recovery gap, wages, inflation, who's bouncing back and who's not. Do you see a two-tier recovery, sweet at the top and tough on the bottom? Are your wages, your paycheck, keeping up with inflation? Or are you still waiting for a top-to-bottom recovery to kick in? Will it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Harry Holzer, professor of public policy at Georgetown University and former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Good evening and welcome, Harry Holzer.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also joining us tonight from Washington is Elise Gould, labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute, a labor-backed research group. Good evening and welcome, Elise Gould.
Good evening.
Elise, I wish you'd take us into the thicket of wages and inflation for a moment. We've seen headlines just in the last couple of days saying wages not keeping up with inflation. What's happening there exactly?
Well, in six of the last 7 months, we've seen a decline in real wages. Wages are now at $15.65 an hour. And this, again, is average hourly wages for non-supervisory workers.
Okay.
That's about 80% of the workforce. And that fell from $15.86 in November of 2003. And it's down since the recovery began in November 2001.
So, and that's being driven by inflation. So in inflation-adjusted terms, you're saying the average wage is headed down, not up.
Right, right. But it's not only driven by inflation. The current decline of real wages is due to, I would say, three factors. The first and most important factor is the lingering effect of the formerly jobless recovery. So it's taken a long time for the jobs to come back, and we're still down 1.2 million jobs since the recession began.
And that translates into lower wages because there's not enough competition for workers to drive wages up?
Right. There's considerable slack in the labor market. So we're still at 5.6% unemployment. And at that level, workers don't have the bargaining power to bid their wages up.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right. The second is the quality of the net new jobs created is putting downward pressure on wage growth. So we're seeing that the jobs that are adding more quickly are in industries and occupations that pay on average 7% than those that are growing more slowly. And so that puts pressure on average wages.
Now, President Bush's campaign, though, is saying that there's been net employment growth in occupations with above-average pay. Or more net employment growth there.
There are definitely ways to cherry-pick the statistics. I would argue that,
of course,
I've looked at this in many different cuts of industries. If you look at different industries or if you do industry and occupation cuts as they do, using the same numbers they have, if you look at the share of growth, and that's what's important, is that the ones that are growing faster, those are actually paying lower wages than the ones that are growing slower.
So lower-paying jobs growing more quickly and then inflation.
I'm sorry.
And then inflation is the last driver here?
Yes, inflation is the last driver. But even with inflation, just nominal wage growth has slowed sharply from an annual average of 2.9% in the second quarter of last year to 2.1% in the same quarter this year. So if you were to look at inflation during the same period accelerated from 2.2 to 2.8, if you had kept it at that same 2.2% as we had last year, wages would be stagnant at best.
Harry Holzer, let me bring you in. If we'll talk about the whole spectrum here, but if we have listeners who are not at the top end, but who are somewhere in the middle, low middle, bottom, can they look forward to all this turning around when and if the recovery continues to move ahead?
I think the answer is yes, but the real question is when and how quickly. I agree with a lot of what Elise said. Job growth has returned. Chairman Greenspan is correct about that. Last 4 to 6 months, there's been a pickup, but we remain really far in the hole. Elise said we're over a million jobs down from where we were at the beginning of this, and that's true. Compared to where we would have been in the absence of a downturn, we're anywhere from 5 to 7 million jobs down. So the labor market does remain very weak. With the level of job growth we have right now, it's not strong enough to really decrease the unemployment rate very much, to draw people back into the labor force. Keep in mind, we need about 175,000 new jobs a month just to absorb population growth, new workers entering the labor market. We've done a little better than that over the last 4 to 6 months, not a lot better. So you're beginning to see some recovery in the labor market, just not quickly enough to turn this situation around anytime really soon.
We've got to take a short break. Elise Gould, I want to thank you for joining us for a couple of minutes tonight. Very grateful to have you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Elise Gould, labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute. We are talking tonight about the economic recovery gap, about wages and inflation, about who's bouncing back and who's not. Question for you, has the recovery shown up in your household? Are you one of those consumers now snatching up new BMWs and $500 shoes, or are you still waiting? Do you see a two-tier recovery, sweet at the top and tough at the bottom? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the economic recovery gap, about wages, inflation, who's bouncing back and who's not. You can join the conversation. Are your wages, your paycheck, keeping up with inflation? Consumer prices are up 3.3% since last August. Has your income kept pace? And is it two Americas after all, or are we just waiting for the rest of the recovery to kick in? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Today, before Congress, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan spoke to whose wages are rising and whose are not.
To be sure, the increases in average hourly earnings of non-supervisory workers have been subdued in recent months and barely budged in June. The larger wage gains for supervisory workers, together with anecdotal reports of growing skill shortages, are consistent with earlier evidence of rising wage premiums for skilled workers relative to less skilled workers.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan speaking to Congress earlier today. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Harry Holzer, professor of public policy at Georgetown University and former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Harry Holzer, you were chief economist there at the end of the Clinton administration, by which time there had been pretty full unemployment for quite a while, and things were beginning to work out well for low-income earners. But is this a typical pattern, then? Is it typical that early in a recovery you won't see so much for the bottom tier, that they have to sort of wait in line and it trickles down or shows up later on?
That's true to some extent. Part of the reason for that is when the economy starts to recover from a downturn, the labor market lags behind a little bit. So employment is one of the last things to start recovering. And less skilled workers within, when there's a downturn, get hurt harder by that downturn and have to wait longer for the recovery to help them. So there's some truth to what you say, that there's part of a natural process where they have to wait. On the other hand, there's a sense right now that things are, the gap between these two groups is really quite dramatic. We've had very, very high productivity growth in this downturn. Productivity growth in the last 12 months or during calendar year 2003 averaged over 4%. Now, that means that on average, everybody's earnings and everybody's incomes ought to be rising by 4%. Instead, even after inflation, the earnings of non-supervisory workers are falling. In other words, the pie is growing quite rapidly, and yet the slices of the pie going to less educated workers are getting smaller, not larger.
Is this
so
back to the
contrast is really unusual.
Is this back to what we hear about productivity, that in the absence of overall pressure on the labor market, it can actually work against workers because employers don't need as many to produce the same output?
Yeah, in the short run, I think that's correct. In other words, over the long term, virtually everybody would agree that productivity growth is a good thing. And that eventually there's always enough demand for what goods for the goods and services workers are producing for there to be pressure in the labor market and for those gains to be shared. Sometimes in the short run you can have an imbalance, which is what we've had the last 3 years, where productivity growth is so strong and the demand for those goods and services is not quite as strong. And therefore, like you said, employers can get the job done without hiring a lot of workers, you know, and generating what you might call a buyer's market.
A buyer's market for workers.
Pardon me?
A buyer's market for workers, for
That's
labor.
Right. That's right, where the employer, all the advantages are with the employers, and they just don't have to work very hard to attract or retain the workers they have.
Harry Holzer, stand by. I want to turn to Ann Arbor, Michigan for a moment, where we're joined by Richard Curtin. He's director of consumer surveys at the University of Michigan. Good evening and welcome, Richard Curtin.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You've been paying attention to how consumer confidence is riding along, and you found a marked difference in consumer confidence index levels for lower income and upper income households. What have you found?
Well, the the largest difference was in how they evaluated their current financial situation rather than the rate of inflation or unemployment and so forth. And in that, we have now twice as many high-income households, and there I'm defining it as above median income, above $50,000,
okay,
who think that their financial situation has improved than among lower-income households. And even more surprising, the number of people among the lower-income households that report improvement is well below where it was, say, in 2000 when the economy was doing quite well. It's about half that, and it's at its lowest level we've recorded since then in the June survey.
So is this just typical? Do higher-income households always feel that they're better off or getting better off relative to lower-income homes?
Well, they do. And, of course, that is true by definition. That's how they get to be higher income. They have higher percentage changes in their income. But this was in terms of the change. The change among higher income households, they started out very positive and fell in the recession and have recouped all of that by June of this year, where lower income households remain at the low level that they first recorded about a year ago.
So, Harry Holzer, what's the big theory of the case here, that we've got a sort of temporary patch here, or that this is part of a longer-term trend toward, you know, the sort of barbell economy, heavy at the top and heavy at the bottom?
I think both those things are true. I think there's a short-run story and a long-run story, and right now we're feeling the effects of both. The short-run story is mostly the one that we've been talking about, where demand for goods and services has not been strong enough to outpace productivity growth, and so employers don't need to hire a lot of workers, especially unskilled workers. Now, I say that's short run. It's been going on for three and a half years,
yeah.
And I think it's going to go on for a bit longer. But then there's another story that John Hilzenrath alluded to, and that's a long-run story about trends in technology, in globalization, and some other forces. In general, making more skilled and more educated workers more valuable in the labor market and therefore leading to wider gaps all the time between the educated and the less educated, or the skilled and the unskilled. And so even if we fully recover from the situation, even if we go back to where we were in the late 1990s, you will continue to see these widening gaps between the high end and the low end of the labor market. Right now, that's all exacerbated by the lack of the short-term lack of demand in the economy.
Richard Curtin, we'll talk more later about the economic structure beneath that, but just simply in terms of consumer confidence, which you track, do you correlate that to political outcomes? If you've got this high level of unease, unhappiness among a part of a portion of households, is that likely to have a political whack to it?
It often does. When you look back over the last 50 years and ask the question that you might be interested in, do incumbents get reelected, it turns out that if the Consumer Sentiment Index, which we measure is at or near its peak in terms of its cyclical developments, then the incumbent gets reelected. And if it's not at a peak, they lose. And currently, we're sort of halfway between where confidence remains high enough that it's still at a level comparable to the peaks in the 60s and 70s. But because we recorded this all-time peak in recently, in 2000, it's below that. So if you think, and this is the first re-election campaign that we observed where it's the two haven't gone together. That is, we're not at a peak. We're at a peak, but it's not the change has not been positive during this presidency.
But what about the kind of twin peaks angle on this? If you have, of course, your overall number is at a kind of peak, but you've described how different categories of income household have very different attitudes. How's that likely to play?
Well, that I think it shows in the very even division between the two candidates. And I think in terms of the economics, most consumers are well aware of the trends we've been talking about tonight. And they see their stake very clearly, and they're very partisan about it. So I would expect it to be a tight election right into the end.
Richard Curtin, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Welcome.
Richard Curtin, Director of Consumer Surveys at the University of Michigan. I want to turn now to Washington, where Tim Kaine is joining us. He's a senior economist with the Heritage Foundation. Good evening and welcome, Tim Kaine.
Oh, thanks very much.
Thanks for coming on, Tim. How are you interpreting what's out there? You know how the Democrats are certain to interpret this. It appears to fit right in with John Edwards' Two Americas theme. On the other hand, we're hearing some economists saying, well, this is just the way recoveries go, and the rest of the train is coming along for lower-income workers. How do you see what's happening, Tim?
I guess there are two points I'd want to emphasize. One is really keying off the Edwards comments that Kerry is, you know, very, very similar to. They see two Americas, but they also see two worlds, and they want to, you know, have all of Americans get, I guess, the same amount of pay. But they want to get that by closing us off. I mean, I found the rhetoric during the primary that was so hostile to India and China very disturbing, and my vision of what the Democratic Party should be is to represent our idealism and that we would want to see prosperity growing in those countries. And so, you know, latching onto this outsourcing ghost story, I think, has been a little disappointing.
You see, they want the same amount of pay, but I've never heard that. I've heard them complain about the disparity, the degree of disparity. That's quite a different thing, isn't it?
I guess I'm tweaking noses a little bit here.
Okay.
And so the second big trend that I see is growth in real wages here at home. Now, the critics have rightfully focused on the drop-off in real earnings in the last 6 or 7 months, and it's disturbing if it continues. But if we look back, say, comparing today, real wages after inflation to 1999 or 2000, you'd believe that they were much lower if you listen to the skeptics. But in fact, real wages are 10, 15 cents higher, even after the losses in the last few months. Over the last 3 years, or during the Bush presidency, the lower-class workers, the lower-skilled workers, have actually done very well.
Harry Holzer, I can't keep track of all this now. I thought that they were not doing so well, and Tim Kaine says real wages up.
Depending on when you look, you can find some increases, but they're really very, very modest. We're talking about a couple of percentage point increases over 3 years or 4 years, a time period during which productivity has gone up by as much as 12 to 15%. So the increases in real earnings are at the bottom end are very, very small compared to the increases in productivity that we've experienced.
Let's hear some testimony from our callers. We've got a lot of them on the line. Lorraine is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Lorraine. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
One of the points that I don't think I'm hearing enough is about underemployment, the industry shifts. For example, a good example, my husband and his best friend were both technical workers in very specialized fields. Those jobs just went away in 2001. Since then, they've taken anything they can. His best friend has literally cleaned out warehouses after fires. My husband's working in a lumber mill. And even if those industries come back, we have men in their 40s who have been out of their technical fields for 3 years, they doubt they're ever going to get back in there.
And you're talking about your own family in part here, Lorraine.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear about the recovery happening at the top end and the word is, wait, the train's coming for you, do you believe it? Are you confident of that?
I don't. You know, we're at a time in our life. We've had to dip into our 401ks during the periods of unemployment. We're looking at, you know, are these people like my husband now stuck in these unskilled jobs, are they ever going to be able to get back into a higher earning job? What are we doing for our retirement?
Tim Kaine, what do you say to Lorraine in Green Bay?
Oh, my heart goes out to you. I actually was part of a what you'd call a dot-com startup, and we all lost our jobs, and so I've been in that exact boat, and there's no easy way out of it. But unfortunately, I have to be the hard-hearted guy, and I look at statistics as an economist, and 19 out of 20 Americans essentially that want to work have work. Now, I think she points
But that's Lorraine's point, isn't it? Her husband's working and his friend, but they're cleaning warehouses instead of their technical work.
Absolutely. That happens. I mean, people in all of our families have lost jobs before, and it takes a long time to get back on track. And like I said, there's no easy answer there. But it's not unique to 2003 or 2002. This happened in 98. It happened in 99. During the best of economic times, companies, you know, go under or you know, the workforce restructures.
But the difference was then, of course, it didn't take 3 years to find another job, and people had a pretty good shot at finding a job in their field.
No, and that's true. Of the 1 out of 20 Americans right now who are unemployed, the average duration of that spell is about 20 weeks. It's actually, I'm sorry, that's right, the average duration. Median duration is only 10 weeks. So we all have to struggle with this, and we have friends that do, but that's part of capitalism. I mean, it creates jobs and it destroys jobs, and nobody would have imagined 15 years ago that their kid would have said, you know, Dad, I want to be a web designer, because that field just didn't exist. So the jobs that are being created, they require new skills, but they're very high paying, frankly, and I think it's a much brighter future out there than what you hear from the pessimists.
And Harry Holzer, what do you say? The same old, capitalism is ever thus, or do we have, are we in a different gulch here?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the underemployment issue is a serious problem. A lot of people are working. There are people who are working part-time, but they'd rather work full-time. There are people working full-time at wages much below the levels they were trained for. There's always some of that, but again, it is a more serious problem when the labor market is weak and when you haven't recovered from the recession. In the period of the late 90s, a lot of these dislocations were occurring, but the economy was generating so many new jobs at all levels that there were many more opportunities for people to switch into a different field, maybe with a lag, maybe, you know, getting some training. That isn't occurring right now to nearly the same extent. So people who get dislocated right now spend a lot longer in that situation that the caller just described, where they're underemployed and earning a lot less than they should be. The other thing I want to say here is, you know, capitalism is a great system, and it does generate income gains over time, but it has a certain harshness that we can tame with the policy choices we make. We could do a lot more to help people that lose their jobs, either through dislocations or other things, through unemployment insurance, through health insurance policies, through all kinds of retraining programs. I'm sad to say the Bush administration has a terrible record on those things. They've been cutting those programs rather than supporting them. We could do a much better job to tame the harshest edges of capitalism and to mean that the burdens borne by these workers wouldn't be that harsh.
Tim Kaine, how about it? Could the Bush administration have done a better job of blunting the edges, the impact here?
Well, yeah. Among my liberal friends, we actually are all in agreement that Bush, I don't know if it was luck or if it was intent, but he got very lucky and with his tax cut. It was the best time tax cut ever, and thankfully, you know, and created great incentives for companies to reinvest, which investment had been horribly stagnant for the quarters before. And frankly, we've seen a great job pickup in the employment numbers. I remember Gephardt saying that the three issues in this campaign would be jobs, 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 and, well, that looks like a win for the president and a win-win.
Well, we've seen it very recently, and there's still some concern about whether it's keeping up with the need for jobs. We're hearing tonight that there's still not enough job creation to keep wages abreast of inflation.
That's a fact, although in the last 2 years of the Clinton presidency, real earnings for non-executive workers, non-supervisory workers, were stuck at $8. 1999, it was below $8. By the end of 2001, it was $8.03. And today, I think it's about $8.15. So, you know, we've made really good progress if we look over the last 3 years. Instead of just narrowing on when the bad news is, we have to make a fair benchmark here. And this president really has done a pretty good job.
Tim Kaine, Harry Holzer, stand by. We're talking tonight about the economic recovery gap. You can join the conversation. Are you confident that recovery is on the way for the bottom half or more for your household? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the economic recovery gap, about wages, inflation, who's bouncing back and who's not. You can join the conversation tonight. Has the recovery shown up in your household? Can you remember what inflation does to a stagnant wage? And where is the end of the two-tier recovery? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Tim Kaine, senior economist with the Heritage Foundation in Washington, and also in Washington tonight, Harry Holzer, former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor under Bill Clinton, now professor of public policy at Georgetown University. And right now on the line, Bill calling from Hayward, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good
I just have a couple of things I want to mention, and then I'm going to get off and listen to a response on air.
Okay, have at it.
First of all, the Bush tax cut, and I make in the upper 40s
okay.
per year.
Yep.
I'm a middle-aged guy. I have a high-tech job. I work in computer networking.
Okay.
And the tax cut amounted to a whole $9 every 2 weeks for me to take home.
Go wild. Go wild, Bill.
$234 a year. The $300 check, well, you know, it's $300. You know, I mean, I just don't know what to say. I definitely think it's a two-tiered recovery. I don't see my wages on the way up. And, in fact, you know, being in the business that I'm in, I'm always looking for new opportunities. And I'm seeing on the web now, as I do job searches,
yeah.
and I do them every night,
yeah.
I'm seeing them looking for people with master's to PhD level degrees to do what I do and pay $50,000 a year.
Tim or Bill, so, let me ask you then, what about Tim Kaine's argument that even if you only got $9 every 2 weeks, that the tax cuts put money into the hands of people who invested them, and he's giving credit to that for getting the economy moving again? So is it still worthwhile?
That's a really good thing, other than the fact that it appears that the money that's being put in by those that got the big chunks back are either going to the car companies, BMW, Mercedes, Cadillac, et cetera,
yep.
or, and that's good if they're buying U.S., either that or they're going into jobs that, again, are part of globalization, NAFTA jobs overseas.
Bill, we've got
no good in this country.
We've got it, and we thank you for your call. Tim Kaine, what do you say to our caller, Bill?
Well, I think if there were any Honda workers in Ohio, you know, Honda invested in huge factories there, they'd kind of cringe at those comments. And I think I hear where Bill's coming from.
He's saying American-made is good by him.
Well, American-made's great, and Japanese-made tends to be good, but we live in a globalized society, and 95% of the human population lives outside of our borders. So, you know, it's usually the hard-right Republicans that are the America-firsters, and that's really split the political spectrum. I'm still sort of a, you know, let's make sure everybody in the world does well. I want to see prosperity everywhere, and I want to see it here at home, too. But his point that he didn't get much of a tax cut, I mean, I didn't get any tax cut because my wife and I don't pay any taxes. We have three kids and a lot of expenses and not a huge amount of income.
Lucky
and
you,
I don't,
in
I don't
a way.
Begrudge the people that got a tax cut that actually, you know, Bill Gates certainly got one, but gee whiz, he pays a ton of money to the federal government every year.
Harry Holzer, let me put this to you. You can hear this persistent concern about how globalization is going to work out. I'm guessing that caller Bill wants the rest of the world to do poorly, but the concern about it coming out of his hide and that of others in his situation, is it possible that if American wages don't keep up with inflation, this is just kind of the way of knocking American wages down into a more competitive position globally?
There's a couple issues here. I think international forces and globalization have been a fairly small part of the overall story in terms of why workers in the U.S. haven't done better. I wouldn't say they're a zero part of that story. I think they're a small part of the story, whether it's import competition or outsourcing or offshoring jobs. Those numbers aren't nearly as large as some people think they are.
But isn't the effect there, John, from the Wall Street Journal, John Hilzenrath was saying earlier, he sees this as a key reason that some American wages are not going up because pressure abroad.
I think it's one reason, but
yeah.
I think it's a much smaller reason than many others, like technological change. And it does, you know, I think in general, foreign trade, imports and exports, I think they do other good things for the average American worker, like they help to bring in lower price, higher quality products that benefit all consumers. So in general, I think trade is still a plus for the American economy, although I do realize that some small groups of workers may get hurt by it. But I also want to weigh in on this whole issue of the tax cut and the president's policy. Mm. Because there, I think I'm in virtually total agreement with Bill. Let's be really honest. These tax cuts were very, very heavily skewed towards high-income people.
Top 20% got 77% of the 2003 cut, I'm reading here.
That's right. And the deficits these cuts have created are going to hurt this economy a lot in the long run. I mean, the $9 every 2 weeks that Bill gets is going to be swamped by the higher interest rates that he and others are going to have to pay if and when these deficits persist down the road, which they will, it will raise interest rates, it will lower economic growth, it will reduce government expenditures on programs that Americans like Social Security and Medicare, or it will require other tax increases that will hit people like Bill a lot harder in the future. Things like payroll tax increases. You know, we're cutting taxes for the millionaires, yet payroll tax increases have been going up quite dramatically over the last two decades. And it's not the Bill Gateses of the world that are paying those. It's the Bills of the world. Those taxes hit people earning $85,000 to $90,000 much harder, or less than that, much harder than they hit people in the top 5 to 10%. So the tax cuts are terrible from an equity point of view. They're going to cause a lot of hardship in the future in terms of higher interest rates and slower growth and other adjustments. And I don't think they have added that much stimulus to the economy. I don't think they've added that much new investment to the economy. Investment is much more influenced by other factors, like the amount of overcapacity we had in the industry, the bubble burst. That took some time to play itself out.
Yeah, we've got to, I want to get Tim Kaine in here. Tim, what about it, the deficits and interest rates, and looping back to inflation, is there a danger that those deficits and the interest rates they'll inevitably bring keep driving inflation ahead of wage rates?
I don't worry about the deficit issue as much, but I agree that on principle we shouldn't spend money that our kids are going to have to pay in the future on things we want today. Just the principle of it's wrong. And I think it's really because Congress hasn't been able to get a handle on spending. But I'd agree that it's a concern, although, you know, economists left and right, the consensus will be a tax cut will stimulate the economy. If it goes to rich people, and frankly they're the ones that are paying the bulk of taxes, I mean, I think it's the top 5% pays 44% of the revenues to the government.
But if it comes back around and bites in the end with the deficits, have we really come out ahead?
No, there's two ways to fund the government. It's either through taxes directly or through deficits, and the way you can get away from both of those is lower spending. There are hard choices to make, and that includes military spending as well. So, you know, there are no sacred cows here, but Congress really needs to find a different way to go on a diet. But to your point on inflation, absolutely, it's like acid rain. It just erodes everybody's income, and when you don't have a lot of income to begin with, it's a horrible thing to see. But frankly, Alan Greenspan has done a really good job during his very long tenure, starting under President Reagan, with controlling inflation and bringing it to heel. So I think we're seeing something that a 20-year-old out there doesn't understand. They say, oh my gosh, inflation of 3% a year, that sounds horrible. It's really, really tame compared to what it once was. And I think the economists of the world have figured out how to keep it under control. So I do look more at the issues of technology change, and this is where Harry and I are in total agreement. Technology is changing faster and faster, and it puts a lot of pressure on the workforce to keep its skills sharp. And do we have the right policies to help Americans prepare for the jobs of the future? Because protecting jobs of the past, it has failed every place it's been tried in history. You can't freeze or else you give up progress.
Well, I have to say that's a big and open question whether the U.S. Has policies to prepare its workers for the future, given everything we've heard on this program in recent months. A big open question, but we hope that those two tiers find a way to get together. That's going to take some work to make it happen. Tim Kaine, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. Tim Kaine, senior economist with the Heritage Foundation, and Harry Holzer, professor of public policy at Georgetown University, former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Thanks for being with us from Washington tonight.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, lamenting the 35th birthday, this is On Point. Thirty-five years ago today, Earthlings first made contact with the moon.
I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And 35 years ago, the world first laid eyes on Frank Nepa. The Pittsburgh writer survived 34 years worth of birthdays without too much trauma. But in this radio diary, Frank Nepa says turning 35 hit him hard.
You hear a lot of talk about all of the angst and emotional turmoil that come along with turning 30 or 40. I even heard Larry King whine for a whole hour on CNN a few months back about what a drag it was to turn 70. But the most traumatic birthday of them all really has to be 35. Reaching this milestone packs a wallop like no other age, and no less an authority than the U.S. Constitution tells us this is so. The Founding Fathers, never once to sugarcoat things, put it starkly in Article 2, Section 1. No person except a natural-born citizen shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years. If those couple of dozen words don't scare you, here's an exercise that I want you to try. On the morning of your 35th birthday, crawl out of bed, make your way to a mirror, and take a good hard look at yourself. Look at your 3 days unshaven face and your Indiana University 1987 NCAA basketball champions t-shirt, purchased in 1987. Now turn to the side and look at the clothes strewn all over your bedroom floor. And then take a look at that huge stack of unopened mail on the dresser, and after that, the empty Chicken McNuggets container and the dog-eared Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Now try this phrase on for size. President, you. The authors of our Constitution, bright men all, writing with an almost divine foresight, seem to have gotten just about everything right. And these men, in their infinite wisdom, deemed that at the magical age of 35, an American will have achieved the level of maturity and knowledge and trustworthiness necessary to run the whole damn country. I don't know about you, but this strikes me as a pretty big deal. And yet the 30-year-olds are the ones who get their own birthday card. The scary part is that I do not measure up. My complete lack of accomplishment, not to mention leadership skills and financial wherewithal, have left me way back in the polls. I don't have a smiling blonde wife or a pretty blonde daughter just accepted into Dartmouth. I do have a mother and two aunts who, on my 35th, dropped by my place with a cake and proceeded to make my bed. I don't have a vision for my future, let alone the country's, and people think Bush is bad. My entire economic stimulus plan would involve free microwave popcorn after your 10th blockbuster rental. So I'm sorry, but I don't want to hear any complaining about any of these other birthdays. This is the one that haunts you. 35 is the birthday where it first sinks in that time is truly of the essence, that you can continue with the fantasy football leagues and watching the OC if you want to, but you do so at your own peril, leaving you no real chance of ever capturing Illinois' 22 electoral votes. 35 is really the only birthday that tells you in more ways than one that you have a long way to go. At least that's what it told me. And so I've been trying to straighten up a little bit. I've been devising a foreign policy strategy with a few of my advisors. Actually, I've merely decided that I want to visit Italy again. But that's a start, right? And I think I've found a way to fund my campaign for the White House. I should make millions with my idea for a new birthday card. On the front are the lines from our Constitution outlining the age requirements to qualify to become President of the United States. On the inside, it says, Happy 35th. Now, my friend, James Madison and the boys think it's about time that you grew the hell up.
Frank Nepa is a lawyer and writer. He lives in Pittsburgh. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Tim Skog, and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point.